G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White is back again. Good morning, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. How are you today?
Going great.
That's good.
How could you not be? Yep. Upright. Breathing.
Yes.
It's a terrific result.
It's certainly not as hot as it was yesterday. There's almost a bit of rain about this morning. A little misty sort of mizzle.
There was... Is mizzle a word?
Well, I think it is.
Is it misty drizzle?
Yes. That's what I would describe it as. And it was
not,
one of
it's
those.
It's not dristy? Sort of, you could have gone dristy and you've gone, mizzle.
Dristy. I've gone with mizzle. And it's one of those things where, you know, it's just annoying enough that you need to put the windscreen wipers on. With the dust around yesterday, it creates some activity where you need to get the water stuff coming out of the thing. What do you call that?
The
what would
water
you call
stuff.
That?
Well, the water.
Yeah, but use like a thing you hit. The button on your phone.
Oh, the lid. On your phone. If you're windscreen wiping from your phone, now this is an advance in technology.
Yeah, no, whatever it is. But you put it on and it washes away the stuff and all that sort of business. So that was that this morning.
Right.
You might just take the fire out of the greens later on today, potentially.
Oh, there's going to be some fiery action, is there?
Well, there might be. Yeah. I invited you to play and you said you couldn't.
No, that's true.
I'm just keeping my options open.
Is this... And Ernie L's keeping his option open sort of move, that you are putting your hand up just in case something goes wrong for the international team?
No, I'm not playing well enough.
Oh, boy.
No. Last week was a real setback.
you got to move forward. You've got to move forward without worrying about what's happening in the rearview mirror. Look through the windscreen. Windscreen. That's where we watch the world go by. Adam Ramanaskis, speaking of dristy, loves dristy mornings. He's the best at that. Former Bombers champ these days. Manager to the stars. And we're seeing a lot more of him on a Tuesday morning early in the week on the Breakfast Club. And we're very happy about this. Good morning, Ramo.
Good morning. Yes, well, that's... Well, I won't say it's not through choice because I love being here. But I think poor old Haysto is quite busy trying to establish what he's doing down in Frankston. So happy to fill in and help out.
He's become a builder type person.
Yeah.
Overalls and...
No, I'm
paint
happy to fill
him.
In for my mate Haysto. He's a good man. He's a very good man.
Well, where is he?
I think
he's not working this hour of the morning. He's on the tools.
He's on the tools.
At six?
He'll be listening.
Come off it.
He's working to a deadline.
Yes.
Come off it.
Yes. It's all good. It's all fine.
Right.
Very interesting night, though.
What do you mean?
Russia no more in sport.
Well, this is a very, very...
No more. They're done.
Very interesting. Well, just for the next 4 years, it seems.
Well, that's right. They're done.
Next 4 years. If you haven't heard
the news...
Allowed
to compete under their flag, all sort. No major competitions in the country.
Now, we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, I reckon, with one of our correspondents from the AAP, I think it might have been at the time, about the challenge that they faced to clear their name, Russia, so to speak. But not only will Russia be ruled out of the next Olympic cycle, its government officials will be barred from attending major events and the country will lose the right to host or bid for tournaments. Under the sanctions, the four-year sanctions, Russian sportsmen and women will still be allowed to compete at the Olympics next year, but only if they can demonstrate they were not part of what WADA believes was a state-sponsored system of doping. So they can compete, some of these athletes, should they be able to prove their honesty and their integrity and their lack of cheating, and they will be able to compete under the, what do they do, the international
flag.
International flag?
Yep.
Well, there's a few versions of that. Remember, there was the Olympic flag with a unified team?
Yep.
I'm not sure whether that was 92 or around about that time. So that, and there has been other examples of this, yeah, this unified sort of team. I don't know what other flags they've used or whatever, but there has been examples of that in the past involving Russia.
Yeah. These are major sanctions. Oh. Major.
Now, does it apply to the World Cup as well?
Yes.
Soccer?
2022 World Cup.
Yeah.
So, and what they can do, and we'll talk to Rick Mays from the Washington Post in about 15 minutes' time, so he can clarify this, but... They can kind of get to choose when they start the ban from. So if they want to compete in Tokyo next year, they can, as Russia, but it'll mean that they can't compete in Paris in 2024. So they either start it now and get it done, or they can essentially choose when they want to start their 4 years, and that's when it's finalised, and that's when they've got to, you know, suck it up.
Suck it up. Yes, okay. Well, it's a big story in the world of sport. Clearly, like to have this to happen where you've got a whole country banned, it must be some unbelievably sophisticated cheating going on.
Yeah. Well, we've seen, you know, we've seen some of the stuff that they've done.
No, that's true. But I mean, the fact that we learnt through the Icarus situation that what had happened and what was happening, and everyone knew it became a documentary. We knew what was happening. Like, you might want to shut it down around about then because everyone knows.
That's right.
But it continued to roll.
But it kind of goes back to the Sochi Winter Olympics, which were held in Russia, and it was almost like a stage-managed event where it was all about winning gold medals in front of their home fans. And it was, you know, and then there's all these people that were completely innocent and naive to it all were part of the movie. Where they were just coming second and third and to the Russians who were on the gear.
It's almost laughable that a country in this day and age still think they can cheat and get away with it.
Well, I don't think it is laughable because I reckon there are plenty of people out there that are cheating and getting away with it.
No, but this is a whole nation. This is state-sponsored doping.
Yes.
There's not too many countries that are out there.
This is planned.
Well, that's true. That's true, but I still think there are plenty of people out there that are cheating. And this is the whole thing as to why I find it hard to watch the Tour de France or watch the Olympics, because I know that there are people out there that are cheating.
Yeah, that's all very well and good, and I don't dispute any of that. But we have a whole country, a state-sponsored program.
The biggest country in the world.
The biggest country in the world who decide, you know what we should do? We should try and just cheat a few times and get a few more gold medals. I understand the ego in sport, and I understand winning and what it does for people, but it does seem extreme measures to just get a few golds for the country. Like, think about it. Just put it simply. It is absolutely ridiculous. Ludicrous is what it is.
It does feel like 1940s, 50s type behaviour. 30s.
West Germany.
Yeah, well, even right back to Nazi Germany with, you know, the Olympics in Berlin. And it does feel that it's not.
Did you commentate those Olympics?
Yeah.
Is that on one of your overseas trips?
Yeah. Gee whiz. Whoa.
Oh.
It's that last bit that really...
We're going to need to cut Bryce out of that. So I need just my man on that one. We have to edit Bryce McGain out of that last bit.
Going there with his commentary.
He jumps in late with, oh!
I'll save you that for after seven.
I need more Gee Whiz action from Adam White in my world. But if I was talking about Russia, I was explaining the impact it would have to the world, I would say...
Gee Whiz! Whoa!
Oh!
It's great.
You can laugh as much as you like. I was just capturing the mood of the situation.
Right.
You know, sure, Marsh had just been hit on the head from a good length delivery.
Well,
it wasn't quite a good length delivery.
Well, no, it was a Yorker. Basically full toss at his ankles and somehow jumped without hitting the pitch.
Isn't it amazing? We have a test match starting on Thursday, and all the talk has been about the MCG pitch, which... It's still
some time.
No, but it is unusual.
No, there's a pretty significant test match happening on Boxing Day.
No, yes, I understand all right. that. But it is unusual from the point of view of that the pitch in Perth could also have some of its own issues. Now, I know it hasn't happened yet, but I think there should be a bit more focus on what could potentially happen rather than what has happened. Well, we're also talking about what might happen at the MCG rather than what has happened.
No, but we've seen what has happened at the MCG like 4 days ago.
That was
ago. Like
completely irrelevant.
That was viewed with our own eyes.
We saw
completely
that.
Irrelevant.
And we're talking about 100 years of tradition and cricket history against two at Perth Stadium.
Oh, I'd love for it to stay. You know, it's part of, I guess, tradition of Australian cricket for a long time. And, the Boxing Day Test in Melbourne is something that I look forward to every year. It's a great occasion, and I'd love for Melbourne to keep it.
He'd love for Melbourne to keep it. We would too, must be said. That was Steve Smith, who's getting ready for the series against New Zealand starting on Thursday in Perth. Talking about the MCG wicket, and he would like the test match at Boxing Day to stay at the MCG. There's been some interesting conversation, which I'll get to shortly, about the MCG and its place in Australian sport in the last couple of days as well. But what happened, Rama, is they've called in the big guns to the MCG. Revered curator and groundsman extraordinaire, Les Burdett, who we've been talking about I think even the 12th man in those tapes even gave Les a mention.
Yep.
He's that famous. At Adelaide Oval for 40 years, he was in charge of that that square at the Adelaide Oval. Did a hell of a job. He retired in 2010 and now is a TIFF consultant.
Consultant.
And curator consultant around
that's what I want to be that. You get paid a lot of money to do that job.
He has been levered in to the MCG to help Matty Page out to prepare this wicket for the MCG Boxing Day test in a couple of weeks' time.
He's a touch and feel man rather than a data and science man.
Now, that is my favourite piece, and I knew you'd love that. Yeah. Knew you'd love that.
Old school.
Yeah, read the story from, who's writing the story? Sammy Landsberg and Ben Horn today. His old school methods, they say, favouring touch and feel over data and science are highly respected. Now, as soon as I read that, I thought of you two straight away, and I thought, oh, this is a man after their own hearts.
You got to lay on the grass. You got to take it in. You got to cuddle it. Even give it a little kiss every now and then. You got to be one with the grass. Whitey knows this. You got to be one with the grass.
Well, Les wants to be one with the grass. Well, he wants to be one of two with the grass with Matty. So Matty's got some assistance. You know, Matty, Adam White, you are basically best mates. My understanding is he's keen to give you a cylinder mower at some stage. What would Matthew think about this, having Les, the doyen, coming in to ride shotgun for the next couple of weeks?
I think it would be embraced, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. You know him, but
no,
I don't know him.
I don't know him that well, but I think...
You're basically best mates.
I think it's one of those situations that he clearly is under pressure now. Whether he likes it or not. Now, I don't want to keep going over old ground.
And they're shoehorning Les in.
Yeah,
he's under
I don't
pressure.
Want to go over old ground, but he was doing this under instruction from outside his own forces. So it wasn't as though Matt was told to go and do what he wants to do completely. He has been given some strong encouragement to go a certain way.
And Stuart Fox did mention that in his press conference.
And so I think that needs to be put on the table. But I think if he can help him alleviate the stress and alleviate the pressure and to help create, if he has got the ability to help create a better test wicket, then I think you'd take that, wouldn't you?
Well, I would. He needs to get this right. This needs to be a very good wicket in 2 weeks' time. It has to be. There's enormous pressure on him. And if he can have some of that alleviated by having Les riding shotgun and Les comes in with a mentoring type arm around the shoulder, then I think it's a really positive move. In fact, I applaud the MCC or whoever's made this decision, Cricket Australia, for getting Les in.
In the ICC guidelines, do we know what is actually classified as a good wicket?
No. Each pitch around the world...
He's emotional again.
Each pitch around Australia has...
Because we keep hearing
has its own characteristics.
Poor or average or
whatever. I mean, I think it wasn't up to standard according to the ICC for the game against England. Then last year, I think it was deemed average.
Yep. So where's the gradings or the classification?
Well, who does the gradings? The referee or do they have an independent turf expert that comes in? And like
Les,
the herbs and spices.
Les comes in.
Yeah. I mean, I think as I said to you, without going over old ground again. I have no doubt that the test pitch will be fine. Is it going to be as quick as we all want it to be? Probably not, but that's what the surface is at the MCG. There will be a better balance between bat and ball, but I think the issue is still going to be it's quite slow. So it's better than it was, but it is still going to be quite slow. It's going to be hard to bat, so I don't envisage there's going to be 380 runs scored on the first day. I think it's going to be a 7-for-250 type situation. Now, that's not everyone's cup of tea, but that's the surface we've got at the MCG.
But isn't that
a cooler climate, all that sort of thing, doesn't make it easier to put some pace into the pitch.
Isn't that what the officials are after? They want that balance between bat and ball.
That's right, they do. But I think
all one-way batting action.
I think half it's a society thing, isn't it, though, that everything needs to happen quickly. And I think in an ideal world, you get the ball seaming around a lot, but you'd also get some pace in the wicket so that if players are playing drives, they're able to confidently get on the front foot and hit the ball down the ground for four. That's difficult to do at the MCG. It just is. So which means the scoring rates aren't high. And I think, as I said, that's what, in an ideal world, you want high scoring rates, but you want wickets falling. You want the match moving forward. That's the sort of the new age test cricket. That tends to happen in England, but the conditions in England are completely different, whether that be the pitch or the ball.
So that's the feedback coming through from R&D, telling us that Perth wicket last week was graded as average.
Last year.
There was a result last year in Perth, was there not?
Yep, but we saw a situation. As I'm saying, I reckon if I'd prefer to be a curator at the moment, whether that be the MCG curator or the Perth Stadium curator, I'd prefer to be the MCG curator. Because the Perth curator has a huge issue on his hands in that there's going to be, you know, consecutive days in the 40s for this test match.
Yeah.
And the pitch that was used against India last year was bordering on dangerous. Mm. We saw pitch situations where the ball was really jumping off cracks and it was quite dry. They're under a lot of pressure as well to get it right, because there's dangerous for it being too soft, but there's also dangerous for it cracking and doing all sorts of things as a result of that too. And that pitch is new.
You're putting pressure on Perth, curator. Is this what you're doing, trying to deflect? Put pressure on Perth?
No, I'm just going on what happened last year.
This is reverse psychology. There's no doubt this is a push. This is a concerted push from the corridors of power inside the curation room at the MCG. Is curation a word? To put pressure on Perth to take some heat off Melbourne. That's what I'm hearing over there on the other side of the desk, Grandma.
There's got to be a lot of heat in Perth.
Steve Smith spoke about those cracks yesterday. Let's have a listen to the former Aussie skipper.
Good question. I'm sure the first few days it'll hold together pretty well, but you know, we've seen here in the past, games at the Wacker, for instance, you know, the cracks come into play late in the game, and if it's as hot as it says it's going to be, they could potentially come into play, which I think's good. When the cracks come into play, it's a bit of a, you know, it's something that plays on your mind. You look down and you see these things, and generally the balls that get you out don't touch the cracks. They're sort of just playing in your mind. So a lot of the guys have played when the wickets have been cracked and been able to play reasonably well. So hopefully we can, if it does happen, we can adjust to it.
All right, there's Steve Smith talking about that situation.
I think it'll be very interesting.
Putting no more pressure. This is really piling.
Well,
in
as
now,
I said to
it?
You, it'll bake in the sun.
Well, it's not the curator's fault.
Yeah. You can't do much about the sun.
Would want to be green to start with. See, I just, you know, I can go back to the Perth Seamos days, who was the curator back in the '80s. Tony Ware in the '90s.
In Perth.
In Melbourne. You know, the curators just roll off the tongue. You know, like this is my sort of wheelhouse. I know that this guy in Perth, he's going to find it difficult. It's going to be difficult for him. It's going to be a challenge because of the hot weather.
Just water in the morning, dries in the afternoon.
Well, you're not allowed to water it once it tests
out. It's pretty hot in India and places like that.
Nobody will see.
Their pitches are just low, flat, slow. They don't break up completely.
Well, India can do whatever they like.
They don't break up. You're saying there's going to be cracks the size of...
Well, India just become dust bowls.
Yeah.
I'm all for dust. In fact, it's interesting you bring that up, Rama, the Indian situation, because Australia has its own challenges for creating wickets these days. And, of course, with the drop-in scenarios that are now at play in most of the venues around the nation, it becomes more difficult. And Steve Smith was talking about that again yesterday, the battle to create pitches in Australia that aren't flat.
I know the SCG, particularly early in the season, it's very tough for them to get a wicket up. You know, we saw... with the rugby league and the AFL being played on the ground, you know, we had a shield game moved, and then the shield game we played there was a very low and slow wicket that didn't offer a great deal. So, you know, it can be very difficult for the groundsman to produce anything with any kind of life just because of the volume of traffic, I guess, that gets on the ground. So the guys try their hardest and prepare what they can with what they're given, and you know, the more they do it, I'm sure the better they'll get. And, I guess what we want to see is just consistency with, you know, a challenge between bat and ball. I think that's the most important thing from my point of view.
Steve Smith there talking about the challenges that curators face across the nation these days.
You know who was a real hero out of the game at the MCG that lasted 5 minutes was Jake Carter. No, not a lot's been said about Jake Carter.
No, there hasn't been a lot about Jake.
Because Jake was the opening batsman for WA that was able to bat the entire first session and not get out. So he actually did quite well. So there's a text that's come through from John saying, can we explain why the match was abandoned because WA were 3 for 80? It's not like they were 7 for 10. But the problem was, when it was soft early, Victoria didn't bowl very well. They didn't bowl at stumps. And any opportunity WA just not play the ball, that's what happened. At one point, Carter went forward to play a forward defensive shot, or sort of punch it up to mid-off. And it stopped on him, and it went over mid-off's head down to the boundary for four, completely unintentionally. But what happened was, as it started to harden and get a little bit more pace into it, that was when it started to get a bit more dangerous, because it was still getting through the surface and hitting some of the divots. So I hope that makes sense. But we really want to move on from it, don't we? But it is quite interesting.
You do. You're putting heaps of pressure
on
Perth.
But that's going to be... That will
your
be...
Your man's under the gun.
That's going to...
Les has come in over the top.
Completely going to be the storyline once this Perth test finishes.
Correct.
How's the pitch? How's the pitch?
I know.
And, by the way, we live in Melbourne, so the conversation is very Melbourne-centric just at the moment in terms of the media and what's happening, even though there is a test match in Perth on Thursday, which you are just putting enormous pressure on the ground staff for. Enormous pressure. I've actually never heard you go this hard on someone.
No.
This is quite an effort by you. By the way, off the SMS...
You know what, he is a little bit disappointed. We only got a picture of the day one pitch. We usually get all 4 days.
No, that's true.
There was no more than one
I understand
day.
That, but well, you were disappointed that you couldn't do that.
I love doing that.
I know you do. I love seeing those photos.
I assess. Yeah. I walk up and down the pitch.
I want a bit more information, not just day two, pitch day three.
I wouldn't mind rail out 3 metres.
This is where the ball needs to pitch. There's footmarks here. Such and such is going to come into play.
The issue for me is that the next Shield game for me to commentate, which is my favourite thing to do, and I don't do it very often anymore, isn't until March.
Oh God, you're going to be an angry man.
So you're
angry.
You and Campbell will be practicing just off the TV. A couple of tests coming up. Big Bash, just sitting there commentating.
We have our own radio station.
Yeah.
Well,
the boys and I.
You know what? You've just got me thinking. This whole Twitch thing. You can get on Twitch and do your commentary. You and Campbell can make a Dad and Dave type situation.
I struggle to get on Netflix. I don't think I'll be doing Twitch.
No, well, Jeremy Lolling has got me thinking about this, and you are the perfect Twitch man. You're a Twitcher, I reckon.
Gee whiz.
Correct.
Oh.
Imagine having that on Twitch, the overlay of the sporting activity going on around the world.
Point.
You could be one of the great worldwide Twitch phenomena.
Big Brother's coming back. We could commentate Big Brother.
Does that happen?
That's sort of... Well,
that'd be like Gogglebox, wouldn't it? That's more a Gogglebox situation.
Good.
You sit there on the couch and just...
You're right, because Whitey does go a little bit quiet over the festive season with social media.
That's true. There's nothing to commentate.
Well, I'm on holidays. I don't need to be on social
media. Well, maybe there's just a little, little two-minute sort of segments with you and Campbell that you can...
Come on, move on. This is rubbish.
No, I think
we're onto something here.
We're onto something here. I'd be disappointed if there's more pressure put on Perth from Whitey today. I'd be disappointed if that comes up again. Just trying to deflect from what's happening over there at the MCG. But Les is in town, so we'll be okay. We'll be okay. Rama, I noticed, and we're going to speak to Jason McCartney after 7 o'clock, but these 7-year deals are going around willy-nilly at the moment. It's a good time to be a manager, I reckon.
That's good.
Cashing in on the 3.5% or whatever.
Well, he deserves it. He's a good player.
Whatever you're rorting.
I would say the way the game's played now, Lockie Whitfield's in the top 3 or 4 players in the competition. So this is a massive, massive thing for the Giants. And I know there are a number of clubs that were into him to try and prize him out of there a year before the end of his contract, and it was going to be unlikely, but they asked the question. Going into next year, remember the fact that the commentary won't be about him because he's signed up before the next season starts. But with the way the game is played, it's more so a running game and good decision making, good skills, which is he's got all of that. He is, I think, the quintessential player going into 2020.
The beauty for the Giants now, effectively, they own him for the remainder of his prime career. Let's call it. I think he comes out of contract at 32.
33.
Yeah. So. Now, if he does ever want to leave for whatever reason, the Giants will get full value because they own his contract. Can't be any more simpler than that. And he's just a good player. He's a terrific player. He's one of best and fairest. He's been an All-Australian. Obviously, he wasn't at his best in the grand final after having his appendix out a week or so earlier, but he is a very... And Whitey is right. The way football is played now, it's a perfect game for Lockie Whitfield.
And he had a run of games last year. We're talking about football again, Daniel. He had a run of games this year where he was clearly the best player in the competition, and then he just had a few injuries, which he broke his collarbone, I think, by memory, which made it was a bit harder for him, but obviously because he wasn't playing. But
so we can ask Jason McCartney about, they got probably two more big ones, Zach Williams and then Jeremy Cameron. They can get those two done somehow, I think.
How are they fitting them all in?
I think Cameron will get done.
How do they fit them all in?
Pay him a number and it sort of just then goes into the salary cap.
Is it, you're an idiot.
Is it one of those situations? I'm just going to ignore that. that immaturity. As we look, there's commentary. It's back on the screen. Daniel, there it is.
Gee, well, in fact, there's a vision of Peter Siddle coming in. He's just about to bowl. It's bounced up. What's happened?
Gee, whiz.
Whoa.
Oh. this is just rubbish. What I was going to say, Ramit, was now I've completely lost my train of thought. No, I haven't. Is it because now they're not going down the path of bringing in the older players, your Brett Delidio's?
Well, they are the older players now.
But they're gone.
No, but so, I'm saying Cameron.
No, but they have
Cornelio,
had.
Ward and Davis are the older players
that's
now.
That's right. Yeah. But they have had that situation they've brought in senior players and put them on big money. Heath Shaw, Brett Delidio, Steve Johnson, etc. They're not doing that now. So does that help keep those players and put them on longer term contracts?
They're now a traditional football club in the way their list is set up.
Correct. That's my point.
Yes. Yeah. So they've got those older players locked in. They continue now to replenish through the draft rather than having to replenish with older players.
And the question I want to ask Jason McCartney is, have they been forced into a situation similar to Hawthorn and Geelong where they've had to go to players and say, look, we now can't pay you probably what you want, but if we're going to keep you all, you're going to have to take deductions.
What's Russ Milton's middle name? We'll find out. He's about to join us to discuss the weekend in the English Premier League. Good morning, Russ.
Good day, boys. How are you? You well?
We're going very well, thank you, buddy. What's your middle name, Russ?
Michael.
Michael. Russell Michael Milton. That works for us. Nice.
That's it, really. Yeah. Ian Terence Botham, that was a big one from the past.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
It used to be ITB, it was weird, wasn't it? They used to do that all the time,
Not anymore. What's Jamie Vardy's middle name? Because he's hot to trot. He's become, I believe, Russ, the second player ever to score 8 consecutive goals in the Premier League twice. Well, score 8 times in 8 games twice.
Yeah, he's got the record, hasn't he? I think it was 11, wasn't it? 11 straight goals, 11 straight games, sorry. So he's on for that again. I mean, there's no stopping him, really. He's flying, as are Leicester. He got 2, didn't he, just over 24 hours ago against Aston Villa. And they're looking very good. And that's 28 goals in 34 games he's got. So Leicester are looking imperious. A 4-1 win over Aston Villa look very good. So much deserved. And they march on. And as well as they're doing, they've actually got more points this season than when they won the league 3 or 4 years ago. But they're still 8 points off the mighty Liverpool.
Well, not for the total for the year. This point in the year, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. This in the season, this point, they actually got more. They're 3 or 4 points more. Better off than when they won the league. So, yeah. So, they're going really well. But you can't see anyone stopping Liverpool, can you, really, at the minute?
Well, Russ, don't worry about Liverpool or Leicester or Jamie Vardy. Let's talk about my boys, United. They're just brilliant. City are pretty good. United, we're back. I think we're back, Russ.
They were fantastic. I mean, yeah, they were unbelievable. Many people have been saying it's United of old, which it probably was. You know, certainly for the first half an hour, you know, they made City look also rans. Man City, yes, they had a lot of the ball, but United on the counter-attack, when they were great, and they got such good pace in their team with, you know, Rashford, Martial, Lingard, young Dan James, looks a terrific player. And it could have been 4 or 5 up. It was 2-2 up, wasn't it, at half-time. City came back a little bit in the second half, but United were very good defensively as well. So, you know, yes, I don't think it masks the fact that United do need a few players, but because the lads they've got at the minute are very young. They can't seem to be able to do it week in, week out. But, you know, so that's 5 games unbeaten now for Man United. 3 wins, 2 draws. They beat Tottenham in the week, didn't they, 2-1. And then followed that up, obviously, with the win at City. So, and people were saying about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, he's got 2 games. I thought these 2 games, he gets, he, you know, could well get the sack if he doesn't do well in them. and they go and win both games, and we're very good value for both wins. So it looks like, yeah, United are back in some ways. So, very good they were.
It's interesting, Russ, because Tottenham have turned it around. Manchester United have turned it around. But Arsenal haven't yet, and they've got a big game that's starting in around about 15 minutes against West Ham. It is away from home for Arsenal, albeit a London derby. Is the pressure still building on Arsenal, even though they've sacked the coach?
Well, I think there's, not a lot's changed since Freddie Ljungberg's been in, two games. I would love to see Freddie Ljungberg do well. I would love him to get the job. I think he's a great man. He obviously was there for many years as one of the invincibles there when they went through the season unbeaten. So I hope he doesn't ruin his legacy there. They've had a draw and a win. A draw and a loss in the two games. I mean, Arsenal away from home in the last few years have been woeful anyway, so I'm not sure they're going to get anything out of this one either. West Ham themselves have only won one in nine, so it's going to be, who's going to be less rubbish, I think, tonight. But, you know, that's the way it is at the minute. I think Arsenal's players, you've had Emery getting the sack, and then you've had Ljungberg take over. No managerial bounce from that. I think the players got to look at themselves. There's a lot of high-profile players there on big money. I think they've got to start turning up and producing the goods. And there's no real sign of who's going to come in at the minute at Arsenal. You know, there's been rumours of two or three coaches being sounded out. But it's worrying times at the minute, and I think most people, like myself, can only see them drifting a bit further down the league before they go up the league.
I'm going to go with one from complete left field here for you, Russ. Ange Postecoglou was the Socceroos coach. He coached Melbourne Victory to titles here, Brisbane Roar to titles here. He's just won the J-League in Japan. Is he someone that is on the radar at all? Not necessarily at Arsenal, but he's someone that he's spoken about. You, as someone that's managed teams before yourself and still involved now, is he on the radar?
I haven't heard his name, actually. Obviously, I've heard from us just chatting, and you know, he's got a good reputation in the game, but I've not heard his name mentioned in any of the for any of the posts here at the minute. I mean, it's not to say it won't happen, because you know, the people always pop up out of nowhere, and the names come to the forefront. He could well be one of them. Mikel Arteta's one of them as well. For me, that's not a good one, although he's number two at Man City with Pep Guardiola. You know, it's a whole different ball game being the number one. He's got no experience. Patrick Vieira is another one, at least he has managed, you know, former Arsenal captain. Max Allegri, Juventus coach, is another one, but he's never managed in England, doesn't speak English very well. So you got the same problem as Emery when he first came in. There's a few. Pochettino was mentioned, but he wouldn't jump ship and go across, you know, from Tottenham to Arsenal. I very much doubt. Plus, there's a small factor of the £12 million payoff he got. So I think, I think he'll keep hold of that rather than stir a few fans.
The Washington Post journalist Rick May has been good enough to join us to talk about Russia's four-year WADA ban that's been handed down overnight. Rick, good morning.
How are you guys doing today?
We're going really well, thank you, sir. For our audience, for our listeners, can you explain exactly what's happened, what WADA have found overnight, and the outcomes for Russia?
Yeah, it sounds like we've been talking about Russia and doping for several years now, but yeah. What we saw today is the most severe punishment to date. Russia was actually reinstated, their anti-doping agency was reinstated a couple years ago, and part of that reinstatement, they had to turn over some data and information with WADA. Well, it turns out they tampered and manipulated that data, which WADA was none too pleased about. So the executive committee, they met Monday in Switzerland, and they voted unanimously to finally levy a four-year ban. So what that means is, Russia cannot appear in the Tokyo Olympics, the Beijing Olympics in 2022. Their athletes can still compete without a formal affiliation with Russia, but the country itself will not be in those games, and also FIFA World Cup and a variety of other world championships and international events.
So we were talking before, Rick, about the opportunity that Russia have to delay it, so they might be able to squeeze Tokyo in and miss Paris. Is that right?
Yeah, well, so what they did today is they basically voted to send them an issue of non-compliance. That triggers the clock. So they have 21 days now to protest to the court and file an appeal. And from there, who knows? It just depends on how long the court actually takes to hear the case. But nothing becomes official, and the four-year ban doesn't start until the court until Russia says we're not going to challenge it, or the court says, hey, this is final. So if for some reason that court proceeding goes into next summer, then, yeah, you can see a scenario where the clock doesn't start ticking for even longer. But I have a hard time thinking it's going to last quite that long.
What was, did they put up any level of defence in this? Was it a hearing such where they could state their case and plead their innocence to a degree, or was it just a straight out assessment from the integrity committee?
Yeah, their defense is going to be interesting because they've actually been a little bit open. Their new head of RUSADA is named Yuri Gainis, and he was expecting this and has said they need some change. I think that what he told reporters today is that these old school approaches have to be replaced, and then Russia competitively has to start taking a different approach. So on one hand, some of their officials are kind of being a little bit more open and honest about things. On the other hand, they're still digging their heels in. They're not admitting to everything, and clearly by just looking at this tampering and manipulation of data, they're not being as open with investigators as they can be.
Rick, current athletes, what's the process for them to continue to compete?
Yeah, so it's very similar to what we saw with the 2018 Winter Games in Pyeongchang. If you're an athlete, you've never tested positive, you haven't been implicated in the Russian doping scheme, either the McLaren report or any other news reports, you should have a pretty simple case, and you should be able to say, hey, I'm still should be allowed here. I'm sure just as it was in 2018, we're going to have a lot of athletes, even those that have been implicated in the past, they're going to try to make their case and say, hey, I should be allowed to compete. So by no means today's decision, the final word we've heard on this. I think it's just a huge, huge stepping stone, though. It's going to be a major storyline all the way through the games next summer in Tokyo.
The international flag will get a workout, it looks like. With some of the athletes that will be still competing, you imagine. Do you foresee a portion of Russian athletes that won't be competing, if it's Paris or Tokyo, probably more Tokyo, you'd think, that won't be performing?
Well, certainly there's going to be some. I mean, I'd be very curious to see how they handle certain, teams. Like in Pyeongchang, we saw the Russian hockey team competing there, but not as the Russian team. They still sang the anthem and still acted like a team. But there's other team sports where it'll just be curious, not just in the Olympics, but what about FIFA World Cup? So can Russia compete in the qualifiers, which maybe are exempt from some of this World Anti-Doping Code, but then not, at the actual World Cup? I think there's a lot of things that need to be ironed out there. But certainly there's going to be a lot of athletes that are barred just because of today's decision, and a lot more they're going to continue fighting probably right up to the opening ceremonies in Tokyo.
I'm super excited to be here till I'm 33 years old and grey, probably. Saw Cogs go through it last year and Josh the year before that, so they held it really well in the way they were able to keep their form up and all that stuff around the club. But it's a lot of pressure that you probably don't need through the year. And yeah, we met at a really good spot. We've had great talks all through last year as well about extending, so it was a pretty easy one in the end.
That is the voice of Lachie Whitfield, who yesterday announced a 7-year contract extension at the GWS Giants. Of course, they are coming off a grand final performance. They've got a new captain, Stephen Cornelio, and the 25-year-old Whitfield, who's played 133 games for the Giants, ensures he will remain in orange until at least the end of 2027, which, as we were discussing before, boys, as we try to tap into Jason McCartney very shortly, means that there's, what is it, Rammer? Two left. Two of the big guns that need to get locked in for the Giants to go one step further.
Zach Williams and then
Jeremy.
Then the biggest one, Jeremy Cameron. So, look, you don't see any reason why they won't lock in, considering all the re-signings that GWS have had. But, yeah, you do wonder.
Well, I mean,
where's the tipping point?
The thing is going to be with Jeremy Cameron, probably more so than Zach Williams, who's a very good player.
No doubt.
But there are clubs that will go all out for Jeremy Cameron and put things on the table. And I think it'll probably happen last year, to be honest. But, a club like Essendon, if they're going to lose Joe Danaher, they can say, well, we've got the money, Jeremy, if you'd like to come to Essendon. If it doesn't work out for Joe next year, and I'm sure there's other opportunities as well. But, yeah, it's a good challenge for the Giants.
Well, they've got one of their men, and Lachie Whitfield has signed for 7 years, and I reckon that is music to the ears of Jason McCartney, the GWS footy operations manager these days. Good morning, Jase.
Good morning, guys. How you going?
We're going very well, thank you. Appreciate your time on The Breakfast Club. It's a big day, and you were bullish and buoyant yesterday, as you should have been. But when I heard Lachie say that I knew my future was in Sydney for a long time, picture that portrays is this wasn't an overly difficult negotiation.
No, look, it was one, though, that like any negotiation, we started conversation probably about two, half the way during the year. obviously Lockie's manager, Tom Petruro, were working closely with him around the Stephen Canelio negotiation. So sort of towards the back end of that, the attention started to shift towards, you know, what Lockie was thinking and where we could go with that. So once again, pretty much once the season wrapped up, we let the boys go away, kept working with Tom, and we're able to pull that together pretty quickly.
It was interesting, the grab we played out of the break before we got a hold of you, Jace, was he was talking about the distraction through the year. How big an impact do you think what happened to Stephen Canelio has on, or will have on, some of your players in this situation where they're coming out as a free agent and the whole footy world could be talking about them for 12 months and they're just better off getting it over and done with early?
Yeah, I think, once again, it's an individual-based decision around that. Every individual will handle it differently. If I look at probably before my time, Josh Kelly, Josh had a lot of focus on him, had an outstanding year. Obviously, Stephen, prior to the injury, he was playing some really strong footy. So it comes back to the individual and how they want to process things. And Lockie's he's pretty low-key, Lockie. He just loves getting out and playing the game and loves his mates. And that was a big factor in probably him wanting to get it done earlier than later, was that he really loves the place. So he didn't see the opportunity to even contemplate looking at anything else.
I think it was interesting, Jason, that Lockie actually spoke about how, and I think Josh has done the same thing, where being up in Sydney, you get away from that intensity of all the speculation. I'm sure there's been plenty of it, and Stephen Canelio went through it, but it doesn't seem to have that same intensity up there, which means that they can live their lives and play their footy pretty easily.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I've seen it firsthand, being up here regularly over the last couple of years. It's completely different to Melbourne, and the boys do really, they do escape that scrutiny. Sometimes, I suppose, in our area, you'd like it to, when things aren't going as well, you'd like it to be on the boys a little bit more, but,
yep.
Rather than manufactured internally. But, yeah, look, it's different, obviously. It's a wonderful lifestyle. And you can see why the Swans have done it so well for so long. You get your culture right, the environment. It's a great place to live and play elite sport.
I want you to talk a bit more about the culture, because I think there has been this... I think now we can call it a misconception that players, they'll just leave. You know, they'll come to Melbourne for the big money, or they'll go back home. That you are now keeping them on a regular basis. Can you just explain how the culture has developed, even in the time you've been there, to the point now where they're not leaving?
Yeah, I think it starts with, obviously, we've had Phil Davis and Callum Ward do an outstanding job for 8 years as captain. Starts there, Leon as coach, and it just filters through. They, I think the way the club started, and there's so many have been around from the early stages of the formation of the club. And look, they, much to the contrary of some of the beliefs of people back in Victoria, that these boys did it pretty hard. Like, they were getting belted week after week. The club started out at Blacktown, and they were training pre-season on baseball fields and moving around here, there, and everywhere. So it wasn't as easy as some people think it was. So it was really challenging. And as you know, with anyone, you go through hard times. It really does harden you and the experience of it all. It makes you crave those successful times. And look where we are, obviously, the last 4 years. Although we haven't had the ultimate success, we've won finals 4 years in a row. And that helps too with the boys. They can see that, you know, something special is attainable. It's not the sell that it probably was early days at the club, but they can actually, you know, touch it and taste it a little bit. So that all helps, there's no doubt about it.
Another likeable person that we love here on The Breakfast Club, because he loves breakfast. Normally with Dane Zorko. That's going to have to change now, because he's just down the road in Arden Street at the Mighty Kangaroos. Josh Walker is his name. He joins us. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
We are terrific, buddy. Great to have you with us. Now, what are you going to do? Who are you going to have breakfast with now that poor old Dane Zorko's going to have to go solo up there at Brisbane?
I'm sure the North boys will welcome you to their breakfast crew.
Well, they better, because from all reports, you are outstanding company at breakfast, says Dane, and has done for a couple of years. But now you're at the Kangas, mate. You're three clubs in now. How's it feel walking into a third one?
It's definitely easier the third time around. You do get used to it. It's not quite as intimidating as when you're a young kid coming into a club for your first time. But, the North guys have been really good, and, couldn't be easier to sort of spot into, I suppose.
Were you expecting another look?
Yeah, I'm sort of always quietly confident. I thought I'd played enough good footy early in the year to warrant someone giving me another chance.
Oh, I want to ask a question a bit differently. Did you expect to be at Brisbane in 2020?
Yeah, I did, to be honest. I didn't. I thought it was a bit of a surprise. So I was actually on holidays in Europe when I got the news. So there was a sort of a couple of surprise shop days there. But the way it is now, you've got to move on pretty quick, and the managers straight away making phone calls, to see where else we can get.
Yeah, it's interesting because explain your time at Brisbane, because you played a variety of different roles, as you have when you're at Geelong as well. But as the team improved, it was a harder team to, I guess, get a regular game. But you were one of those things that could play lots of different roles, but not necessarily one role. If that makes sense.
That's sort of right. So I suppose I started when I was a forward and spent a couple of years in the forward line. I mean, it wasn't sort of until last year I spent the whole year as a sort of full-time back. So, it did change, but I was still, even last year, started the year really well and in the team. And I don't know, I sort of just ended up on the outer just as a result of some people coming in to trade into the club and just the makeup of the team, the way Fagan liked it. So sadly, I was the one that ended up on the outer.
It seems like you're pretty matter of fact about the whole thing, really. Is that the way? You had 4 years at Geelong, 4 years at Brisbane. Is that sort of the way you need to be in terms of your mentality, that whatever happens, wherever the next opportunity comes, I've just got to be ready to accept it?
Yeah, I think so. There's no point. Obviously, I really enjoy my time at Brisbane and love the club and make great friends up there. So I was obviously not wanting to go anywhere else, but you have to move on quick and have to be ready for what's next, I suppose, in the way it is today. It's a business, and as soon as the club's done with you, they'll give you the boot. So you can't be too blindly loyal, and that's the way it is. And now. North's come up and I'm buying into what they're all about. So that's just the way it is.
Were there other clubs than North Melbourne?
Yeah, there's a couple down in Melbourne. So North.
So why North? Why North Melbourne then? Why did you choose North Melbourne?
Obviously, there's a bit of a hole there with Scott Thompson retiring. I went down and met Ray Shaw and really liked what he had to say and where he wants the group to get to next year and moving forward. So, and just was really enthusiastic about what I could bring. So it just seemed like a good fit, and I felt really comfortable with him. So it was the obvious choice for that.
In the studio today in the Summer Sanctum is one of our favourites in the world of golf. Cam Percy is back home. Cam, good morning.
Yeah, it's actually nice to be here and looking at you instead of just talking to you from a bedroom somewhere where the kids aren't yelling at me.
So. Probably much nicer just looking at the phone rather than looking at us, but we appreciate the sentiment. It's great to have you home. How long are you home for?
I am here till January 6th. I'm flying to Hawaii from here and my family's coming out on Sunday for Christmas. So
right.
We haven't been home for Christmas for 4 or 5 years, so... We're doing that this year.
So how many are coming out?
I've got three boys and a wife. So
all of them?
Yeah, everyone's
fantastic.
Coming out. So.
I thought maybe some of the kids might like to stay with their mates when this sort of thing happens.
Yeah, well, the weather's not real good in Raleigh right now. I think it's -3 or something today. So they're pretty keen to get out here and see all their cousins and all their friends and have a swim and go to the beach and all that sort of stuff.
So how do you go going from weather that's like that into getting to a day like yesterday when it's 40 degrees?
Yeah, yesterday was pretty nasty. It's quite difficult. The last month at home, before I went away to play twice, it didn't get above 45, which is like 2 or 3 degrees. So I've got a mate who lives around the corner who's got a net on his third floor of his house. I'll just go there and whack balls in there. So that's what you got to do.
Why did you get a net on your third floor?
Definitely not.
But definitely if you not. Had a third floor, there would be a net.
Yeah, probably. Probably. So how many if you were to do that, how many balls do you hit?
Well, only I might practice for 2 or 3 hours a day, maybe, max, because it's on the mat, and my wrist at the moment's pretty sore, so I can't hit too many shots. So, yeah, just 2 or 3 hours. And then I've got a laser, this laser I use, and I'll putt on the carpet in the room on that, and That's my practice because it's just too miserable outside.
Because we've talked about this before, the discipline to do it, whether it be in your hotel room between rounds and if you're hitting into a net, that you don't just hit seven balls and go, I'm bored by this, and then you start tinkering with your swing and then all of a sudden you lose everything.
It's
the discipline. I mean, how do you do it?
I've just been doing it for so long now, you're sort of used to it. Just there's a few things in my swing I look at, and I've got this, golf view. It's a camera I can put, and then I can look at my screen as I'm swinging. I put my phone like an inch from the ball, and I can physically see what I'm doing. So it's actually really good for your technique and stuff. So once I get it right, I'm like, all right, I'm good. That's enough. Or else I'll start, like you said, you start tinkering, and you turn into a Padraig Harrington who goes to work on something for 25 minutes, and 7 hours later, he's working on something else. I've seen it. He falls next to me. Yeah. He's like, it looks really good. I'll see you later tomorrow. Yeah, no, we're going to just hit a few more and go. And then you'll go play around and come back, and he's still there. So what happened? He goes, well, I hit one a little bit to the right. And, you know, I felt like my right shoulder just dipped a little bit. And then he's like, he hits shots. He played for a while where he actually walked through the ball and stuff like that. So that's the sort of stuff that you've got to try not to do when you're out there.
Bryson DeChambeau is almost the recent example of that.
Yeah, I saw something. He's trying to get bigger and stronger or something. I mean, he's got huge sense. I played with him about 3 years ago when he got his card, and he was just, you know, a nice athlete. Now he's huge. Like, I don't know what he's doing or what he's on, but he's got very big. Wait, is he playing this week?
Yeah, he is.
He is. I mean, he's massive.
The world's slowest golfer.
Yeah, he's not real quick, is he?
he's not real quick. But
just on that, when you do play with a golfer, do you ever say something? You say, come on, let's speed it up here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or you're sort of like, oh, come on, mate. You know, you can stand in the right spots or come, you know. It's kind of awkward. You know, you don't tell Tiger Woods to hurry it on him, it's really awkward, and you're playing past, like, what are we going to do? What are we going to say? Because the officials are on you, like, they're all over you, and it's really frustrating because I'm a quick player, but every now and then you get a shot where, like, oh, the wind changes, or I'm not sure, and you want to take your time, but you feel under pressure to go, and it's very, very annoying.
So what effect does that have on your game? If you want to play quick, but you're obviously the guy that you're playing with is playing quite slow, is it frustration? Oh. How do you keep yourself in the moment?
Very, very frustrating, and you know you're under pressure to catch up because you're behind all the time, and you know, like I said, there might be a shot that you've got to take a bit more time on, and you're not sure, and then you're yelling at your caddy, come on, mate, get the yardage quick. Come on, you've got to keep up. And then you rush yourself, and you're out of rhythm, and the tour actually, they've got some ideas next year to really change it, and hopefully they kick in and it does improve. Because, like, I play the first groups now. We play in 4 hours 15, 4 hours 20, and they're on us all day. Come on, guys, you're 2 minutes over time, 2 minutes. I'm like, I played the last group last week in 5 hours, and there was no one out there. Like, why are you hassling us? So they're trying to do something about it.
What would you do about it?
Oh, I have a shot clock. Simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a shot clock done. And then you go, you're over 45 seconds, there's a shot. You go over 45 seconds, there's a shot. And all of a sudden, guys will be quick.
Shot penalty?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
right. Only way it's going. Because I was coached by Jason Day's coach for a while, and he's slow, and I talked to him about it, and he goes, he doesn't care. We worked out that the top players, they don't care after playing with them. So they just take their time. They know nothing's going to happen. They're not going to get a shot penalty. $5,000, $10,000, they don't care. They're making $7 million a year. Makes no difference at all. Shot penalty, they're like, all right, we better hurry up now.
Yeah, okay.
And that's the only way it's going to change. That's going to cost them championships and shot and hundreds of thousands of dollars, not $5,000 and $10,000. I don't care about that.
That just sort of got my memory thinking here. I spoke to Aaron Pike yesterday about what it meant to him he's got the Open Championship qualification. Yeah, he played brilliantly well down those final nine holes. And he was talking about trying to find a way to play without the ramifications in his head. And he talked about how, you know, in that last hole where Louis made eagle and hit a 3-wood, and he sort of said, well, look, if Louis hit the ball in the water, he wouldn't care. He'd just pick up another ball, put it out. He makes enough money. Whereas if I had that shot, I'm thinking, oh, you know, this is the difference between all sorts of things. How, and we've talked about this before, but how do you block it out, or can't you? You just got to embrace the circumstances.
You know? It's really funny. You can't block it out because it is what it is. And I remember when I first turned pro, I talked to Peter Senior, and Peter goes, you've got to play like you've got millions of dollars in the bank. And I'm like, well, I don't. You know, I had $400 to my name. And he goes, that's how you got to play, blah, blah. And just recently, like, I've had a good start to the season. And it's the last few weeks I've played, and now I understand what they're talking about. Don't care. I've missed some cuts. I'm like, oh, well, I missed the cut. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm playing now like I don't care, and it's I can't wait to get out there next year because I genuinely don't care. If I hit in the water, I hit it. It's like I'm playing with my mates on a Wednesday now. It's only taken until I'm 45 to get to that position, but it does make a huge, huge difference.
Because it happens, it was Stephen Fleming that started talking about it in cricket with the Melbourne Stars, that he got into the mind of the players that it doesn't matter if you get out.
Right.
And it was a really hard thing for the players to come to terms with, but it was like, well, if you start worrying about getting out, you're not going to be able to do your job for your team.
Yeah.
It's different, you're playing for yourself, but to be able to get that out of your system, and it sort of, you know, you start the season well, it does make a big difference, doesn't it?
Because
everything else is taken care of.
Yeah, like I know there's a guy, Chris Baker, who's just got on tour, and I saw him, and he'd missed every cut. He's already fired his caddy. He's 4 weeks in, he's fired his caddy. He's missed every cut. He's so nervous about the re-rank and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I've been there, you know. I was there the first couple of years. But you just got to keep playing and push through it.
It's amazing.
Well, different.
But it's nice to get. I imagine it's nice to get to that point though, where you are now. That you just doesn't faze you. What happens? Shot, the next shot you play, if it's no good, doesn't faze you. You've got to be able to move forward and give yourself a chance.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you always talk. Everyone talks about process, and it is just a process. And then it all takes care of itself. But until you actually get there, it's like a. I don't know. I've made enough money now where I'm like, all right, if I'm done, I can. Everything's going to be all right, and there's just this weight off my shoulders. Like, you know, I took a risk 10 or 12 years ago, me and my whole family over there. I'm like, geez, I hope this works. And my wife took a risk to come over, and I was like, all right, we've achieved what we need to achieve, and now it's just gravy on top. So it's a nice feeling.
So in saying that, how long do you want to keep playing for then?
I want to play this year. I've always wanted to take my friends to the Masters and my family. That's every golfer's dream is to go to the Masters. And I've been close a few times, and I haven't quite got there. But I've realised, you know, well, maybe that's not going to happen unless I win. So if I can keep my card this year, play next year. And I said to my wife, I'm sick of sitting in a hotel room. I just can't do this anymore. I'm going crazy. So another year or two and I'll be done. And
how many weeks were you in a hotel room this year?
This year, not much. I only played 15 maybe events. So this bit, I hurt my wrist. I was out for 6 months basically. So, but normally 25 to 30 weeks a year, eating dinner by myself, sitting in a hotel room, and I'm like, there's more to life than this. So you know, I'm sick of it, basically.
Who are your mates on tour? Who are the ones you hang out with?
Well, the guys I hang out a lot with Greg Chalmers, and he hasn't played for 18 months, so I haven't been able to hang out with him. I actually hang out with all the caddies. There's about five or six Australian guys that went over and tried to play golf and didn't make it, and they become really good caddies. And they're the guys I hang out with, and we, you know, I'll room with them, I'll stay with them, I eat with them, and all that sort of stuff. So I hang out with them and we talk footy and punt. And they don't talk about golf. That's the best thing.
Yeah.
Some of the guys go out there and you're like, oh, you know, how'd you go today? Oh, and then all of a sudden they're halfway through their round. And it's like, mate, I don't really care what you did on the fourth and all that sort of stuff. I really don't care. So, and the caddies have got the good stories because they're the ones that tell you all the players are like and who's this guy's a prick and that guy did that and how much they're paying and this guy's tight and this guy that. They're the good ones to hang out with. I'm surprised you guys don't interview the caddies. They're the best. They're way more entertaining than the players.
There you go. R&D at the back. We've got a whole new batch of people we can talk to. And they'll tell us good stuff. What happened at the Australian Open for you at the Australian Golf Club last week?
I played nicely the first day. And then the second day, I've just got new contacts. I'm blind as a bat. And I went up a thing. And for some reason, I've had trouble with my left eye. And it was I couldn't see anything. I was blurry.
Imagine that's a setback.
I basically had to close my left eye and try and hit it, and it was terrible. And I hit all over the place, yeah. It was terrible. So you know, I haven't been in the fairway a couple of times with a wedge and made bogey and stuff like that. And ended up in one shot, which is quite annoying.
Yeah.
Everything was. And the smoke up there was, I think, maybe a bit of smoke.
Yeah, what was that like?
It was awful. Like, there was ash on the greens. You're like, getting there. And you literally couldn't. I mean, if you're driving to the city, you couldn't see the city. And just, my throat's a bit sore today, probably just from the smoke. It was terrible up there.
Right.
Like you couldn't see the sun all week. And at 3 o'clock, it felt like it was 7:30 at night. And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that was really eerie. So
wish I knew about the eye issue before I put the multi on.
Yeah. I had a few guys. Someone came up to me and said, oh, we're not going to be friends for a while. I had a five parlay or something, and you were the last leg, and I didn't get up. So That wasn't real good.
Oh, was it nice to play home again, though?
Oh, it's fantastic. The golf course is brilliant.
Yeah.
The golf course was great. It's great coming home to play here, but I just wasn't. I mean, yeah, I've got an issue with my contacts and that. So that's happened. It happened a few weeks ago when I played too, which wasn't real good. So
you got to sort that out, man.
Yeah, I do. Tell me about it.
Sort of trial before you play, sort of.
Well, they were all right. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, man, I closed my... it was all blurry. And that's three times now it's happened. So maybe I just got a bad batch.
Will you play the PGA now you're here, or are you still just...
Nah, because I've got to start... When I start next year, I've got to go January 6th to 6 weeks of golf. So if I play the PGA, that gives me a week and a half to see my family and friends and all that sort of stuff. And my wife's actually here. She'd probably shoot me if I took off again and play a golf tournament.
So what do you do? Like, you've got 3 weeks thereabouts,
yeah.
Maybe 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Do you not play golf? Do you play golf?
No,
do you muck around? What do you do?
I'm going to Cathedral. I'll catch up with all my mates, and they love golf. So we play golf, so it works out good. So I'm going to Cathedral.
Yeah?
So I don't know. My mates are going. Hutchie's a member there. He's taking all of us. Our mates from Warrigal there. Today we're going there and then playing tomorrow. Thursday I'm playing golf with mates. Friday I'm actually going to the golf. And then when the kids arrive Sunday, I'm going to the golf as well to try and keep them up. We'll go there and hang out and hopefully not get invited to the party afterwards, because it gets pretty wild there.
Does
after
it?
Parties, oh yeah.
Is that right?
Ernie Els, you do not want to drink with Ernie Els.
Actually, no, I have heard that.
Yeah, don't be the last one with Ernie Els, because you don't go home for days.
I have heard that. I was actually in a bar, speaking of caddies, in Augusta in 2005 with his caddy after Ernie had done a number on him, and he was in a bad way.
Yeah, it's not good. He was
in a bad way. Very bad way. I've heard some stories about
him. And he can throw a headbutt or two, too, when he's
Well, I reckon Matt Jones practices a bit. I reckon he practices a little bit, because that's what you do when you're one of the world's best. And he's back-to-back, well, not back-to-back, but two Australian Open titles now after winning on the weekend at the Australian Golf Club. He practices a lot, I'm sure. He joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Matt. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Morning, fellas. How you guys doing?
We're going really well, buddy, and really appreciate you jumping on the phone and having a chat to us. That last hole, I'm still getting over that, I must admit. I was watching that unfold live, and clearly you were living it. But when you told Mark Allen at the back of 18 after you'd made that little tiddler for the win that you'd been told that Louis had made par, I almost fell off my chair, Matt.
Yeah, I wasn't too pleased when I found out the situation, because I played the hole differently than I normally would under different circumstances. I was under the assumption that it was either a par or, worst case, a birdie. He definitely told me Louis not making eagle. I thought I had a two-shot lead. So the last hole, my third shot out of the pine bark, whatever that stuff was, I wasn't even trying to hit the green. I was just trying to hit it left. I was happy to hit it left into the people if I had to.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, because up until that point, we were talking about this yesterday, you'd managed the round so well. You did everything you needed to do. You made obviously that huge putt on 17 to basically close it out, even though you didn't know it at the time. And you managed the course and day so well. Did you feel calm all the way through it?
I did, actually. That was, as I said in a media after it, that it's probably the most comfortable I've felt for four tournament rounds. I was very calm. I was very relaxed. Being up with a three-shot lead, it's never comfortable, because you've got to be able to play smart, but you still have to be able to attack and have to make birdies, because you never know what someone can do from behind. But the conditions kind of dictated what I had to do yesterday. I knew there was not going to be too many great rounds, so I just knew, don't make silly mistakes. If you make a bogey, it's all right. You can always have holes out there that you'll be able to make birdies.
How big a factor is the comfort of knowing the course so well when you get to that point, particularly on a Sunday when you're in contention or you're leading and you're a chance? How comforting is that to know the course so well?
It is. It's just very comfortable when you walk onto every hole and you've played it so many times over the years that you know if you miss it in this spot or that spot that you'll be able to what to do from that situation and that where you are on that hole. If you miss it left, well, you know the next shot where you're going to have to hit it here to give yourself the best chance to make a par, get up and down, or make a birdie. Just like I did on 14, the par 5. I mean, I hit it left into the dirt, but I knew that it was still safe compared to, because that wind was in off the right, and if I come out of one and hit it right, it's in a hazard, and then I'm battling to make par. I just played the hole and I played every hole pretty conservatively, not to make just pars, but to make the easiest par I could.
One of the that makes perfect sense. One of the great things of that final round, Matt, was whenever you made a mistake, whenever you made a bogey or hit a bad shot, you then followed it up with a birdie, and it happened quite a bit where you're able to continue to keep that buffer. How proud of you, of yourself, were you, the way you were able to cope with the bad things that happened in that final round under the pressure?
I think if I could go through my scorecard, it would be pretty funny to see for the 4 days, because I think I would have done that nearly every time I made a bogey in the tournament. It seemed like every time I made a bogey, the next hole, I made a birdie. And to do that in the final round was great, because you never want something to snowball or get going, because if you start going down a path, sometimes it can be tough to break. If you get a bogey, then another bogey, they kind of build. But to be able to make that bogey and then birdie, like number seven, it wasn't a good shot, the second shot I hit in the seven, but to be able to come back and birdie eight with a drive a four iron into number eight, that was playing very hard on Sunday. To birdie that hole, because that's a hole you could easily make bogey on. And then you come to nine and it's another hole, it's easy to bogey. But to be able to birdie eight and then par nine, and I know getting into the back nine onto when you start at 10, you got a lot of birdie holes on the back nine. There's probably one or two holes that really aren't birdie holes, and then the others you can get access to all of them.
So we talked about the issues on 18 of not knowing what Louis had done. Are you someone that watches the leaderboards and knows your position, particularly when you are in front and you've got a little bit of a buffer? Tringali made a bit of a run at you on the front nine, but the pressure was coming from a group outside your own. So what was your awareness of what was going on that entire back nine?
The first time I looked, it was when I was going to 13 after I hit my second shot and Louis was walking down 14. I knew I was at 13 under and I saw Louis was at 11. So from there, I thought Louis would make two or three more birdies, so I knew I had to make a couple, because I thought he'd birdie 14 and I thought he'd birdie 18 at worst. So I knew I had to have a couple of birdies to try and match those, if I was lucky enough to do it.
So do you change the way you play, or does it just make you a little bit more steely in the way you go about things? What happens when you're thinking to yourself, right, I've got to make two more birdies?
I just knew I had to execute and hit the shots that I needed, because I know on those holes, I know like 14 is a very good birdie chance, the length of that hole, the very short par five on number 14, sorry. And then 18 is always a good birdie chance. And on the back nine, really, for me, it was just 15 is always a tough par three. That wind's very, very difficult. So if I parred 15, then I knew I'd have good birdie chances on 13, 14, 16, 17, 18, which I didn't on 16 and 18, but I knew I'd have chances. And I knew I'd make one of them the way I was putting.
Thursday morning, we'll be talking about day one action in Perth for the Australia-New Zealand Test Series. It kicks off on Fox Sports. No ads from 3 p.m. Thursday. It's going to be a ripper, and Alan Board is a big part of the Fox cricket team. He joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, AB.
Good morning, boys.
Great to have you with us. We dominated Pakistan. That was a bit of a lackluster affair. Are we expecting a bit more from this series against the Kiwis?
Oh, no doubt about that. New Zealand, they've got a number two ranking in Test cricket, so they're the real deal. They've got a very good group together. Most bases covered, so that'll give us a real good test, that's for sure.
Alan, more importantly, are we the real deal again? Our performances have been pretty good, I think, but against minimal opposition at the moment. Are we the real deal again in the Test arena?
Yeah, look, I think we're getting there. That's seems to be the case. You know, David Warner back making runs at the top of the order. That sort of helps things, doesn't it? And he's been quite amazing since coming back from England. But you're right. It remains to be seen, you know, how much we've moved forward. I think the bowling side of the equation's going great guns, but it's making sure that batting group comes together well. And Warner's done a great. Great work at the top of the order, and in partnership with Burns, I think his inclusion in the side has been very, very positive. So it's all sort of heading in the right direction, but against good opposition, that's when you really get tested out.
So do you think our top six, our batters, are locked in now? Do you think they're the guys that we've got to sort of pick and stick with now?
I'd like to think so. I mean, Travis Head hasn't had much of an opportunity in the home series as yet.
And Matty Wade, they're the two question marks. The other four are pretty much locked in for me for a while now. But, yeah, those two positions, would be good to see, you know, some more contributions from those two guys. But overall, you know, when the group's batting and playing well as a whole, I mean, you tend to sort of hang on to your spot. So I think those two will be right for the short term. But certainly you've got to keep, you know, working hard and making sure that you're contributing all the time.
Manus Labuschagne, has he surprised you in what he's been able to achieve in the last 8 or 9 months?
I'm not overly surprised because he's just one of those kids, you know, he just loves the game, and you know, his work ethic is absolutely fantastic. So, but his improvement's been quite remarkable. You know, from where he was, say, 12, 18 months ago to now, it's a different cricketer. You know, the confidence, his style of play, just the way way he goes about his innings now. You know, he's matured so much. So obviously, just being around guys like Warner and Smith has just really helped him blossom. I think he's just playing really, really well at the moment. So that's a really good positive for Australian cricket, to see these young blokes, you know, when they're given their opportunities, you know, really sort of step up.
We were talking actually about you on this program last week about your abilities for so many years to get tough runs, and that's what Labuschagne has proven to do in his short career, that, you know, ability in adversity to just find a way. Is that something that can be taught, or is it just ingrained in you? You can either do it or you can't.
Look, it's an interesting one, because it's just, you know, sometimes, you know, the ball's got your number on it. You know, you just play out a delivery and it just nips away, catches the edge. I mean, what can you do? But you're right. Getting tough runs is important. You know, when the conditions are more in the bowler's favour, you know, like eking out an ugly sort of 40 or 50, you know, it can be really, really important to the overall, you know, scheme of things. So it's not all about, you know, just going out there and playing, you know, glorious shots and smacking them through covers and playing all those types. So sometimes you've got to, you know, really work hard for your runs. And that's where Marnus has just been outstanding, because he knows how to, you know, ramp it up if the conditions are in your favour and the game's flowing nicely in for you, but also he can sort of drop anchor and play that gritty innings, like we saw from Steve Smith in particular during that Ashes series. You know, he was quite extraordinary, and a lot of the guys have learned a lot from that.
There might need to be some grit from both teams in the next 5 days from Thursday, Alan, when the weather gets hold of them. It's going to be 85 degrees every day, they reckon, over there in Perth. How big a factor will that be, do you think, and the way, what it will do to the pitch?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of the unknown. You know, playing at the new stadium and, you know, the pitch, you know, it's a drop-in, so no one's really sure how that's going to perform. And given the weather conditions, I mean, that's another sort of factor. So we'll play a role, there's no doubt, because... Yeah, over 5 days, you know, there's that sort of exhaustion factor. There's the pitch. How's that going to play? The day-night, you throw that into the equation as well. So it's going to, you know, throw up a few question marks for the players. And, you know, you'd like to think that we've got a slight advantage there, that we played a bit more pink ball test match cricket than New Zealand. But, yeah, they're a good side, and they're a good scrapping side. So that, they'll be up for the challenge for sure.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.